Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What keeps a human being alive and sane when everything normal, familiar, and comfortable in the world is ripped away? Louis Zamperini had experienced more than his share of life's ups and downs even before joining the Army Air Forces as a bombardier in 1941. The son of working-class Italian immigrants, Zamperini's youthful missteps began to darken into full-scale juvenile delinquency until his brother helped him find salvation in running. He was good enough to compete in the 1936 Olympics, but his hopes for gold in the 1940 Games were dashed by the outbreak of the Second World War. At the time, Zamperini could not have imagined that his greatest trials and triumphs were still ahead of him. Author Laura Hillenbrand first learned Zamperini's story during the research phase of writing her 2001 bestseller, Seabiscuit. Her new book is called Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. Laura, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Louis Zamperini did not start life as a person who appeared likely to achieve great things. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of trouble he got into as a kid?
He was a very difficult boy. He was a naturally very defiant kid and a very self-confident kid, an optimist who thought nothing bad was ever going to happen to him. And as a result, he was a prankster, and he was a hellraiser, and he was a thief. He used to actually break into his neighbors' kitchens, and when the housewives were out of the kitchens, he'd steal their entire dinners and run out the door. He once strung piano wire from a church bell into a nearby tree and spent the night ringing it and convincing people that God was making the bell ring. And he got into a lot of brawls. He got very bad grades in school. He was really on his way to a difficult life until his brother kind of strong-armed him into running and discovered Louis was one of the greatest running talents America ever saw.
Yeah, his brother was really an amazing influence on him, in part because as the child of immigrant parents, he served a sort of translating role and had more authority than an older brother might normally have.
His brother was a squeaky clean kid. Just as he was handsome and he was dashing and he was polite to everyone. He was a wonderful boy. He was kind of the opposite of what Louis was. And he kind of thought of Louis a little bit as a son and took care of him. And Louis would listen to Pete, that was his brother's name, when he wouldn't listen to anybody else. And Pete decided that Louis' future lay in running, and boy, was he right.
What's amazing about that is that initially Louis really hated running.
He did. He would just drop down on the ground when he didn't want to run. And he didn't like being controlled. That was the thing. I mean, later he would learn that his body loved to run. It was what it was meant to do. But at the time, he resented anybody trying to make him do anything. And Louis had this nature of when he was pushed, he would always push back. But Pete made him run. Pete would actually get on a bicycle and ride behind him, hitting him in the butt with a stick to keep him going. And all of a sudden, this world-class talent emerges from this juvenile delinquent who looked like he was on his way to prison.
Did he like the attention?
He did. I spoke to some kids who knew him when he was young, and they weren't kids anymore when I spoke to them. But they talked about how he was pretty comfortable in the spotlight, that he was a modest kid, but he did like it. And when he ran his first race, kids started cheering for him. And this was something he'd never experienced before because he was the town delinquent. And he liked it. He liked it just enough to keep training. And eventually he began to love running itself. And after that, he was almost literally unbeatable.
And they called him the Torrance Tornado?
The Torrance Tornado, yes. He was a big newsmaker, not just in his hometown, but if you look in the 1930s newspapers, the Los Angeles Times is just full of stories on the Torrance Tornado, Louis Zamperini. And he was really the local hero, the fastest runner ever to come out of California.
And his college coach said the only person, the only creature that might have beat him was Seabiscuit.
Was Seabiscuit, yes, which was really saying something.
So in 1936, he went to the Olympics. He did not win any medals, but this is sort of chilling. Hitler himself commented on his performance.
Yes, Louis actually, as a Depression-era kid, he was accustomed to not really eating enough. And he came from a very poor family. And they put all of the athletes on the USS Manhattan, and they stocked it to the ceiling with food. And Louis was a teenager at the time and really was not very disciplined about it and ate and ate and ate. He actually gained 12 pounds in 9 days. And he got to the Olympics and he was out of shape and he was fat. And for most of the race, he ran quite a bad race and dropped way behind. And then he just decided to throw himself into it, and he turned loose a final lap in 56 seconds in the 5,000 meters. And to put that into perspective, in the 1930s, it was exceptionally fast to run anything quicker than a 70-second last lap. And he started passing people very, very rapidly. And among the people who saw him was Hitler, who watched him circle the track. And when Louis was done, he called Louis up. And the two of them shook hands. And Louis really had no idea who Hitler was. He pulled out his camera and took a picture of him, but didn't know that he was shaking hands with the greatest monster of the 20th century. Mm. But it was an unusual experience for the kid from Torrance.
What sort of blow was it to him when the Olympics for 1940 were canceled?
It was very difficult for him. He was one of the gold medal favorites. I think he had an excellent chance to have gotten gold or silver. He was really on track to become the world's first four-minute miler way before it was actually done. So it was a crushing blow, and he kind of fell apart emotionally and physically for a while after that. But once the war began, that thought really went out of his head, and that was an interesting thing. He to this day doesn't seem to feel very bad about having lost that chance, because something much more important came along, and that was saving the world, essentially.
Hmm. Yeah, so he started his army training thinking he'd be a pilot, and that did not work out. What happened there?
He got airsick. he originally had a job at an aircraft manufacturing plant and was watching these fighter planes take off, and thought they just seemed amazing. He'd only been in a plane once in his life earlier as a boy, and it had scared him to death, but the flying looks really interesting to him. So he signed on to the Air Corps and tried doing the training, and would get very, very airsick. And he was also very scared while flying the planes. So he washed out, and he didn't realize that when he washed out, he actually signed a paper that was an agreement that if he should ever reenlist, he had to go in the Air Corps again. Well, he was drafted soon after and was sent straight back to the Air Corps, and then they made him a bombardier, and that was a lot more comfortable for him. The flying was straight and level, and he got his air legs under him and was actually fine.
So the flying was straight and level, but you have some amazing descriptions in here about how incredibly difficult it was to work and fly in one of those old B-24s.
Yes, the B-24 was nicknamed the Flying Coffin, and it was for good reason. I mean, it was a very good airplane for what it was, in that they designed this plane and put it up there as rapidly as they could. They were just generating all of this technology for the Air Corps, and these very young men were trying to learn to fly them. The problem wasn't so much the plane itself as just the circumstances of flying in that era. Navigation was extremely difficult, and Louis was stationed in the Pacific, so that the land that navigators were looking for was just flat little islands that were very hard to see, and navigation was quite primitive, and they would miss islands all the time, and planes would simply run out of fuel and go down, and no one would ever hear from the 11 men on board again. And there were a lot of mechanical problems. There were a lot of pilot error issues. One of the most stunning statistics that I came upon in the course of researching this is that 36,000 men in the Air Corps died in non-combat accidents.
Wow.
This blows me away how many people got killed in these planes without being in combat. And when you throw combat into the mix, you're looking at a situation where only 50% of the people survived their tour of duty, which was only 30 to 40 missions. So this was a very, very deadly job.
Yeah, in fact, they had already had a lot of close calls before the incident we're about to talk about.
Yeah, I got hold of Louis' combat diary, and it's quite a thing to read. And it's quite typical of what airmen were dealing with. Just day after day, there were problems and near crashes, and at one point their brakes failed on landing, and they shot off the end of the runway, and they nearly crashed. They got lost in a storm at one point, and the plane was tumbling out of control for several minutes, and they somehow got it under control and got back to the island. And they had quite a time in combat. They had one mission over the island of Nauru, and they were hit by flak, and they were attacked by a number of Zeros, the Japanese fighter plane, which swarmed around them. And they ended up having to fly back with 600 holes in the airplane, including some very, very large holes the size of beach balls. And the plane, one tire had been shot out, The plane had no brakes. It had no hydraulics, so they couldn't raise or lower the flaps. One of the rudders had been shot off, and somehow the pilot got this plane landed.
And he was flying for hours. This wasn't a 5-minute into the landing strip.
This was 7 hours in the air, and half of the crew had been wounded. One of the men would die. The plane was so difficult to control that the pilot, Russell Phillips, who was one of Louis' best friends, actually had to put his feet on the yoke to prevent the plane from flipping upside down. For the entire 7 hours, he was wrestling with it this way. And they had no brakes when they landed, and Louis had an idea, which was to take the men's parachutes, and when the plane touched down, to throw them out the windows, having tied them to the gun mounts, and try to slow the plane that way. They ended up touching down way, way too fast with no brakes. The plane had lost one tire. The tire gouged the runway. That slowed the plane and made it do this very rapid loop. And there was just enough hydraulic fluid left for the co-pilot to stomp on the brake and stop the plane just before it collided with two others.
So everything you've told us so far, Laura, sounds in and of itself like an amazing story, but this is just sort of the prelude. Let's talk about 1943, this incredible irony. They're on a mission to search for another crew that's been lost in the Pacific, and the plane goes down.
Yes. Planes disappeared all the time. This is a very, very common event, and so one of the principal duties of the men in these bombers was to go up and look for other missing men, and they almost never found anybody. The odds of surviving once you hit the water were extremely poor. But they went out, and they were searching around an island called Palmyra. They were about 200 miles north from it. They were flying in a plane that wasn't their usual plane. Their normal plane was called Superman, and it was the one that had 600 holes in it, and it probably never flew again after the Nauru raid. So they were put in a plane that no one wanted to be in. It was this strange plane called Green Hornet, and it was underpowered. No one knew why, but the tail of the plane would fly much lower than the nose. So it was on the edge of stalling all the time, and they were out there alone, and one of the engines died. And this plane was barely able to stay airborne with all four engines, and with three, it started falling. And in the chaos in the cockpit, someone hit the wrong button and stalled a second engine. And the plane spiraled down into the ocean and basically exploded when it hit the water.
So there were life rafts aboard all of these, and in fact, it was Louis' job to make sure that was aboard before they went up in the air.
Yes, there were two life rafts that were built into the plane, and one crewman had the terrible duty of having to stay at the front of the plane as the plane was going down to pull a lever just before it hit the water, which would shoot the rafts out of the roof, and they needed him to wait until just before the crash, or the rafts would land too far away from the crash site for the men to use them. So this poor fellow died doing this. Louis was in the back with a third raft that he had packed into the front of the plane, and he went down with the raft. He ended up kind of hugging it during the crash.
And ultimately, just three crew members made it to one of those rafts.
Yes, they were all on the left side of the plane. It's interesting, the pilot and co-pilot had switched positions during the flight because the co-pilot wanted some experience serving as a pilot so he could become a pilot himself, and this decision may have saved the pilot's life because he was on the left side of the plane and the plane hit on the right. He survived and the other men didn't. But yes, only three men of the 11 on board survived the crash.
Author Laura Hillenbrand is my guest. Her new book is called Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can join us now at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Laura Hillenbrand. Her new book is called Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So, Laura, three souls who had been aboard the Green Hornet survived this crash. You have Louis, of course, the tail gunner known as Mac, and then Phil, Russell Allen Phillips, that they called Phil, who had been the pilot. Now, talk about how they sort of found their way onto the raft.
They all ended up alone in the water with nothing, nothing on them. They had all been thrown about in the plane, and Louis was actually carried down deep under. He was pinned in the wreckage for a while and actually passed out from the pressure, unable to get loose from all these wires. And when he woke up, he was actually loose from the wires. He never understood why and was able to claw his way out of the plane. And he surfaced, and he saw across the water the tail gunner, Mac, who appeared to be uninjured, and then the pilot, Phil, who had a terrible gash on his head that was actually sending blood arcing out of his head. It had hit an artery. And the rafts were quite a ways away, and they were being blown rapidly away by the wind and carried by the current. And Louis swam after one, and it was just getting away from him too quickly, and he gave up for a moment and then realized that there was a cord hanging off the back of the raft really near him, and he was able to grab that and get into the raft, get another raft, and then get over to Phil and slide him up in there and start working on this terrible head wound he had.
And he knew at initially when he saw Phil, he thought, well, I have a choice here. I can either try to get him first in case he goes under, or I can get a raft. And it's a good thing they got the raft because they were in the water for weeks.
Yeah, he could see that Phil needed help immediately or he was going to bleed to death. But he knew if he went straight to Phil, the rafts would be gone and they would all three drown or be taken by sharks. And so he had to go quickly first and try to catch up with the raft. But fortunately, he did catch both rafts and was able to get Phil into his own raft, and he and Mac sat in the separate one. They tied them together.
Describe the rafts and what was aboard them.
The rafts were very small. They were about the size of dining room tables with just a little cushion in the center. There was almost nothing aboard them. This was one of the worst things about it, is once Louis got Phil's bleeding taken care of, He looked into the raft, and there were just a few cans, very small cans of water, little tins, and there were a few chocolate bars that were meant to be eaten just in tiny increments. They were very high calorie. And then there was almost no of other kind of assistance on the raft. There was no knife. There was no fishing net. There were some fishing hooks and line, but they were incredibly poorly equipped rafts, given that people who designed them were anticipating that they were going to be used by men in this desperate circumstance.
So in their exhaustion, they fall asleep. And when Louis wakes up, he makes a horrible discovery.
He does. Phil had given him charge of the raft the evening before. Phil normally would have been in charge because he was the pilot. But he knew he had lost so much blood. He was very woozy. So he gave Louis control of the raft. And Louis was basically the commanding officer from then on. And Louis had decided they were each going to have one square of chocolate in the morning and one square of chocolate in the evening, and they could last for a few days, and hopefully they would be rescued by then. And in the morning, he woke up, and he looked into the little pockets where they kept the chocolate, and the chocolate was gone. The wrappers were gone. There was no sign of them. And he looked over at Mac, the tail gunner, and Mac looked back to him with these guilty eyes, and Louis knew that Mac had panicked in the nighttime and had eaten all of the food they had on the raft. And this was potentially deadly for all of them because very, very few people who ended up on life rafts were ever rescued. So it was a very bad situation they started out in.
What's really amazing about the character of Mac, and he's a real person or was a real person, but is that I think he really demonstrates the idea that mental strength is at least as much part of survival as anything. From the beginning, he was not handling things well.
It's very interesting, and I have a lot of sympathy for Mac because I really don't know how I would handle things, having been in a plane crash, at about 200 miles an hour and seeing most of my friends die and ending up on this huge ocean, knowing that your odds were so long. But he did panic. Right after the crash, he began screaming, "We're all going to die, we're all going to die," and Louis actually had to hit him to calm him down. And then he eats all the chocolate, and he kind of went into a catatonic state after that. But the interesting thing was Louis, Phil, and Mac had all been through the same training, and they'd had basically the same experience, but Louis and Phil remained optimistic through this whole ordeal they were going to go through, and Mac was certain that they were going to die right from the start. And I really don't know what the difference is, if the two other men were just naturally more optimistic people, if they had had experiences in their lives that made them feel like the realm of possibility is bigger and we're going to get out of this. But it was interesting to watch over the course of the 47 days they spent on this raft how Louis and Phil were able to stay optimistic, to keep thinking we're going to get rescued, and how Mac was pessimistic, and the pessimism began to feed his physical decline. Louis and Phil were sort of doing better and better, and Mac was doing worse and worse, and ultimately he would die. And I think one of the reasons he died is that he was so pessimistic.
So Louis and Phil had to use not just what physical strength they had remaining, but it's incredible how clever they were in keeping themselves alive.
They were. They really had to be, because they had nothing out there. Water was an enormous problem right away. They were near the equator, and these were very, very hot days. They had no shelter, and they were very rapidly, severely dehydrated. And when rain squalls came, what they did is they had two air pumps on the raft that were there just in case the raft began to leak. And the pumps came in canvas cases, and Louis took the cases and tore them down their seams and created these big bowls out of them. And at first he was trying to collect to fill the bowls before he poured them into the little water tins. But white caps would slap over the side of the raft and spoil the water, and they knew they couldn't drink any of the salt water, so they'd have to rinse it out and start again. And, you know, by that time, the storm would be over. So what Louis began to do is hold this water-catching device up to his mouth and just let the water flow straight into his mouth, and then he would spit it into the cans, which is kind of disgusting, but I don't think they cared very much, given that they were dying of thirst out there. And for food, there were a few birds that actually landed on their heads or on the raft, which they were able to catch and kill and eat, but there were not very many of them. They figured out how to wrestle sharks onto the raft, small sharks, and they used this odd set of pliers that was on the raft. They never figured out why a set of pliers was stocked on the raft, but they would stab the shark in the eye with it and kill it, and then they would saw the shark open and eat its liver, which was the only edible part. And Louis actually began tying fish hooks to his fingers and trying to grab fish out of the ocean. And he even turned his lieutenant's bin into a fish hook and caught a fish. They were very, very clever out there, and it kept them alive.
Kept them alive, but they were doing very poorly. They had salt sores on their bodies. Can you talk about sort of the state they were in after a few weeks of this?
Yeah, they physically were in just terrible condition. Louis and Phil started the journey. Phil weighed about 150 pounds and Louis weighed about 165, and by the end of it, they were down to about 80 pounds each, possibly less. And their skin, their lips swelled dramatically, so that they were actually, their lower lips were touching their chins, and their upper lips were actually getting in the way of breathing through their noses. Mm. And they got salt sores all over their bodies. And of course, they were very, very sunburned, and on top of that, the rafts were kind of bleeding their bright yellow color right onto the men's skin, so the men turned canary yellow out there. They were really, really struggling, but they managed to keep it all together physically and mentally.
After a few weeks, they did lose Mac, and it might have been tempting for them, given the circumstances, to sort of cannibalize him, but it never even occurred to them.
Yes, cannibalism has been a very common thing to happen in circumstances like this, where people in normal life find that idea just absolutely shocking and think they could never do it. But actually, when people have been castaways, this has happened quite commonly. But for Louis and Phil, it was simply something they couldn't consider. I think Louis felt that it would be kind of an emotional death for him to stoop so low as to eat another human being, you know, and his friend, Mac. So they never considered it. It was absolutely off the table. And when Mac died, they wrapped up his body in something they had on the raft and just slipped it into the water.
So 7 weeks in, they spot what appears to be land. It was the Marshall Islands?
It was, yes. They learned that later. But, yeah, they saw an island.
And it might have seemed that all was well because a boat came along.
Yeah. Well, I think they were worried once they saw the boat. When they saw the island, it was actually interesting how they saw it. The weather was turning very, very bad. And at this point, the raft was in such bad condition. It had been machine gunned earlier. They were attacked from the air by a Japanese bomber. And the raft had, I think, 48 machine gun holes in it that they had patched. The patches were starting to fall off. The raft was turning into jelly. The men were starving to death. They were right at the end. And the weather got really bad, and they got these huge, huge swells in the water. And from the tops of the swells, they started to see islands. And that night, as they were heading toward it, a typhoon went over, and they were nearly killed in the typhoon. But in the morning, they found they were right near islands, and they began rowing toward them. And they knew they had been drifting west, which means they knew they were drifting into Japanese-held territory. And if they saw a boat, it was not going to be friendly. And a boat spotted them, and they rowed as fast as they could, trying to get to shore before the boat got them, but they were just too weak to beat the boat, and they were captured.
And they had drifted 2,000 miles.
They had drifted 2,000 miles in 47 days.
So they're taken aboard this boat and initially treated quite humanely.
Yes, they were given cognac, they were given biscuits, they were taken to an island, a doctor went over them very sympathetically. They were treated with respect by everyone. They were interviewed by Japanese officers, but in a very friendly way. And they were considered guests there. And Phil actually had the thought, these guys are our friends. I'm so happy the Japanese captured us. But the men that captured them were ordered to send them to an island called Kwajalein, which was an island in the Marshalls that had become known as Execution Island because so many prisoners of war were killed there. And Louis and Phil were sent there, and once they got there, the treatment was completely different.
So the people who were in charge there recognized how did they figure out who Louis was?
They interviewed them after their capture, and there were some English-speaking officers, so they learned that Louis was actually a famous man in Japan. Track and field was a very big sport in the 1930s, and he was one of the world's most famous runners. And Japan followed track quite passionately. And so Louis was a pretty well-known man, so people knew who he was.
So that made him too valuable to kill, which would seem like an advantage, but it was not.
Well, it was an advantage at first in that they, after being held for 42 days on Kwajalein, they were condemned to execution. But at the last minute, a Japanese officer intervened, and he had the idea that, look, this man is a famous Olympic athlete. He's famous in America. We can use him for propaganda. So Louis and the pilot were spared, and they were sent to Japan. But it began a whole new hell for Louis because they wanted him to do propaganda broadcasts against America.
And he wouldn't do it?
He wouldn't do it. The first one he was allowed to write himself, and he agreed to do that so long as it was his own text that he was reading. And basically he just wrote something telling his family he was alive because Louis had been declared dead. The American military had no idea he'd survived this crash. And so he was able to let his family know that he was alive. But after he did that first broadcast, they invited him back, and then they wanted him to read something that was a lot more sinister, and they wanted to make him what's called a propaganda prisoner, where he would live at the Tokyo radio studio and read really terrible stuff that would be broadcast to American troops.
So he's there. Talk about how Japanese prisoners of war were treated during the Second World War.
It's difficult to really capture in words how badly the Japanese treated their prisoners of war. The Japanese, as a culture, felt that surrender was an unforgivably awful thing. It's a disgraceful thing, and that people who surrender were worthy of nothing, that they merited death. And that was part of the reason that prisoners of war were treated so badly, because they had surrendered or had been captured, and it was considered so shameful. And there was a great deal of racism toward any outsiders in the Japanese society. And you put those two things together, and you had a situation where prisoners of war were enslaved. Almost all of them were slaves. And they were beaten on a daily basis and degraded and humiliated in a very systematic way. It was truly hell on earth in those camps.
And we associate medical experimentation with Dr. Mengele and the Nazis, but in fact the Japanese were doing it too at that point.
The Japanese did a whole lot of it. They killed probably 10,000 people. Some of them were prisoners of war. Most of them were Chinese civilians and other civilians that they captured. And Louis, when he was being held on Kwajalein, he and Phil were both experimented upon. They were injected with this green liquid that made them quite violently ill, and they were injected over and over again with this. But they ended up being fortunate because they did not die from this, and I think a great majority of the people who were experimented on did die.
There was one individual who seems to have had it out for Louis. They called him the Bird. Can you tell us about him?
The Bird is such an interesting character and a horrible one. He was a very wealthy, very handsome young man from Tokyo who was quite up in arms over the fact that he had not made officer. He had a militarily prestigious family and felt he should have made officer, but he didn't. And he had a real vendetta against prisoners of war who were officers. And he also singled out prisoners of war who were famous in their civilian lives and who refused to grovel before him. Well, Louis was famous in his civilian life. He's an Olympian. He was an officer. He was a lieutenant. And he was a naturally very, very defiant person. And once the two of them met, it was really a showdown for the rest of the war.
So what kinds of things would the Bird do to him that he might not have even done to the other prisoners?
He singled Louis out for beatings almost every day. And they were not just straight beatings. They were very sadistic and also just sadistic ordeals that he would put him through. At one point, he forced Louis to pick up a very long, heavy wooden beam and hold it up over his head in the compound, in the prisoner of war camp compound where everyone could watch. And he told a guard to stand next to Louis, and if Louis dropped the beam, to beat him. So Louis stood there with the beam over his head, and the Bird went and sat on top of a shack and was pointing him out to everyone and laughing and enjoying Louis's torment. And Louis just got into his head, I am not going to drop this beam. I'm not going to satisfy this guy. And he just kept holding it and holding it, and the blood flowed out of his head, and he started to get confused. And the place was sort of swimming around him, and the only thing he could think anymore was that I can't let this guy break me.
Let me have you stop right there because we're going to take a quick break. Laura Hillenbrand is my guest. Her new book is called Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Laura Hillenbrand. Her new book is called Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Laura, we left the last break with Louis standing there, holding this beam overhead and determining that he is not going to put it down.
Yes, and yes, it just went on, and the Bird got more and more impatient, and eventually, he just couldn't wait anymore, and he went over and punched Louis in the stomach. Louis dropped the beam, and it hit him in the head and knocked him out. When he woke up, there was another prisoner of war with him who had been watching the clock while this had been going on, and the prisoner told him he had been holding the beam aloft for 38 minutes.
Hmm.
Just amazing. The two of them were really locked in a battle of wills for the rest of the war.
And I guess in some ways, in that situation, anything you can do to maintain your dignity really matters.
Yes. I mean, this is something that I explore a lot in the course of this book. Dignity turns out to be the most important thing to have in these circumstances, not just in prisoner of war camp, but out on the raft for Louis. It seems to be more important than having food or water or shelter or even air, that men who can hang on to their dignity can hold on to their lives a lot longer than maybe they should have been able to. And the prisoners of war there was a whole underground going on where men were defying the Japanese and finding ways to kind of strike blows against them. And when they were working as slaves, they were knocking over trains and sinking barges and rerouting war material to the wrong places and just constantly doing things to strike blows against the Japanese, and that was the kind of thing that was keeping them alive. And Louis was a very central part of that. He began stealing newspapers, Japanese newspapers, to run them to translators to get war information, which was hugely important to morale. But it was also a potentially very deadly thing to be doing.
We should point out here that the cruelty of the Japanese commanders was not universal. There were, in fact, some people who, at great personal risk, did what they could to give those prisoners of war a bit more dignity.
Yes. Over Louis' experience, there were several people who were just wonderful, and there was a huge amount of pressure on Japanese soldiers to conform to this culture of brutality toward prisoners of war, but there were still some that were willing to risk their own lives to help the prisoners of war. There's one man who really stands out. I read this in an affidavit I found at the National Archives. There was a prisoner who was being beaten with a club in the first camp that Louis was in, and he was on the verge of death from this. And the man who was beating him was called away, and another Japanese soldier was sent in to finish the beating. And when no one was looking, the soldier told this prisoner of war, "Scream as if I'm beating you." And then he took the club and simply hit it against the floor. And this man felt that this Japanese man had saved his life. And this was done at a lot of risk for the Japanese soldier. And there were some wonderful people in the Japanese forces.
So it would seem that the end of the war would be a relief, but the Japanese had made it clear that they would sooner die themselves than give up their prisoners.
Yes. Yeah. And there was something in existence called the kill all order, where the Japanese had determined they did not want any prisoners of war to get back into the hands of the Allies. So their policy was, if there was any risk that the Allies were going to overrun these camps, that all the prisoners of war should be executed. And this was carried out at many different camps as the Allies progressed across the Pacific at some of these outlying camps. All the prisoners of war, they would be burned to death or shot to death. This was something that was hanging over the head of Louis and his fellow prisoners. They actually learned their death date was going to be August 22nd, 1945. Mm-hmm. Well, the atomic bomb was dropped a few days before that, and it saved their lives.
So we know, obviously, that Louis and Phil survived this ordeal, but it wasn't over when they got home.
For the prisoners of war, when the physical ordeal was over, the emotional one had just begun, and most of these people came home very deeply tormented and deeply scarred, and Louis was no exception to this. He really fell apart when he came home. The memories of the bird especially were terrible, and he was having horrible nightmares every night where he would just get drenched in sweat and wake up screaming. He was having flashbacks where he would suddenly be in the war again, and it would all be real, and he wouldn't be able to distinguish that illusion from reality. And he was hallucinating that there were lice on his skin when there weren't. He was getting into fights, and he began to drink very, very heavily. He fought with his wife. He alienated her. And he actually woke up one night kneeling over his pregnant wife, strangling her, thinking she was the bird. And fortunately, she was okay, but she didn't stay much longer after that. He really fell apart.
How did he make contact with Billy Graham?
Through his wife. They had a new neighbor in their apartment building who told them that this young preacher who was not well known at the time, Billy Graham, was speaking in Los Angeles, and Louis did not want to hear about it. He turned and walked away as soon as the guy mentioned this. He was very opposed to these preachers. But Cynthia, Louis's wife, stayed and listened, and she went to Graham, and he helped her. And she talked Louis into going to hear Graham speak, and I won't give away what happened, but what happened there was kind of a magical moment for Louis, and it changed everything. It was the thing that helped him finally come to a place of peace about the war.
So, Laura, he wrote his memoirs after the war. What made you think that you would be able to mine a great deal of new territory by taking this topic on yourself?
Well, autobiography and biography are really different birds. Mm-hmm. And Louis had originally written his memoir back in the 1950s. But as memoirs are, it was looking at his life from the inside, from his immediate experience. And I wanted to broaden the perspective by talking to everybody in his life and all of these other witnesses to the events that happened to him. And I also wanted to use his story to talk about the war in general, about what life was really like for a B-24 airman or for a prisoner of war, and Louis' life was the perfect way to kind of walk someone through the Pacific War to get a real feel of what it was like, what the texture was. So I was kind of surprised no one had ever told the story from this perspective, and there was so much out there to find out, things that Louis never knew about his own story and about things that were happening around him. I kept calling him and telling him, guess what, I just found out. And so we had a wonderful time with it over the 7 years that I worked on it.
Was it hard to gain his trust initially?
Not at all, no. Originally, he didn't really see why I would want to write another book because he had written his autobiography. But I sent him a copy of Seabiscuit, and I talked to him about what I wanted to do, how I wanted to kind of broaden the story in a way that had never been explored before. And he was completely game after that, and then he was just the most marvelous source I could possibly imagine. I mean, he had saved every artifact from his life going back to his birth in 1917. And so there was everything he sent to me. It just made it a great research experience.
How, I don't know, self-aware is he in his diaries? Did they contain elements of his emotions, or was it mostly about the events of his day?
He talked that Louis is from a generation of men that don't talk about their emotions very much. Mm-hmm. So some of it, it was a little bit of reading through the lines. After the Nauru mission that I mentioned, where their plane had 598 holes in it, one of the crewmen, who was Louis' friend, had died, and a whole bunch of the crew members had been lost from the crew forever because they were so badly injured. And it was a very traumatizing experience for Louis, and you can really see that in his combat diary. He talks about how he almost got in a fist fight with someone in a bar, and how he doesn't really want to talk to anybody, and how he's spending hours and hours in his room just listening to music and being by himself. And he's doing a lot of running at the runway, just kind of trying to work out his emotions. But he doesn't talk straight out about his emotions very much, as hardly anyone does in that generation.
Were you surprised at how closely his contemporary interviews tracked with what he had written decades earlier in his diaries?
It really was amazing how consistent everything was. And I'm an obsessive cross-checker. When someone tells me a fact, I try to find something to verify that. And especially when you're dealing with people's memories, you have to check and check and check because people are fallible that way. And his memory was, I've never experienced a memory like this. I mean, he would tell me about a race that he had run in 1932, and he would remember the time down to the fifth of a second, and I would check the local newspapers, and he was right. And right through, he told his story very, very consistently and accurately. He was rarely wrong on a fact, and it made it a very refreshing thing for me to work on.
What did he do for a living after the war?
He tried a lot of different things. I mean, when he was falling apart emotionally, he was kind of doing sort of get-rich-quick schemes, very short-term things, trying to raise money. He became obsessed with murdering the bird, and he wanted to raise enough money to get back to Japan and hunt him down and strangle him. And he was doing a lot of things that were falling through one after another. After he found resolution, he became a public speaker, and he's been that for the rest of his life.
He's such an amazing person. There's a photograph in the book of him skateboarding. This is a sport he took up in his 70s.
Yes.
And he's doing it, I think he's 81 or 82 when that photo was taken in the book.
Yes, he was 81. That's Louis. I mean, I'm pretty sure he's immortal. I'm 43 and he's 93 and he's going to turn 94 very soon, and I'm sure he'll outlive me. Because he's just in amazing shape. He has that Olympic body, and he's a very, very intrepid man. So he only recently gave up skiing, and he's still, you know, hiking, and he's always active. He's amazing that way.
So people have been talking about making a movie about his story for at least 50 years. Why has it never happened?
I don't really know. I'm kind of amazed that nobody has touched it. There have been scripts that have floated around and little efforts periodically, and I think Nicolas Cage wanted to do something about 10 years ago. Now it appears to finally really be getting on track, and it's something that's really going to happen. But I'm dying to see what they do because visually it's such a spectacular story.
Mm-hmm.
But it'll be interesting to see.
It's funny to think how many generations of actors have aged out of that role.
Yes.
Since it actually happened.
Yes, it's true. I think Nick Cage would have been great 15 years ago, but now, you know, like the rest of us, he gets older.
Do you mind if we talk a little bit about your personal experience in writing this book?
Sure.
You have chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yes.
What kind of an impediment is that to doing such an intensive job as writing a book like this?
It was extremely difficult. I had a terrible relapse while I was working on this book, and if people don't know, CFS causes sweats and chills and fevers and swollen lymph nodes. And for me, the most profound thing is exhaustion and a balance disorder. And when I say exhaustion, I mean at times I can't sit up, I can't talk. You know, all I can move is my eyeballs, basically, when I get all the way down in my exhaustion. And I had a terrible relapse, and I actually was unable to leave my house for 2 years. Mm. And this is why the book took me 7 years. It was physically very arduous to do. But on the other hand, it's when you're completely incapacitated to live in a life of this much vigor as Louis has. I mean, to really escape from my body and live his life with him, it just breathes life into me. It was a wonderful escape for me to work on this.
It's such a remarkable perspective, because I would think that it would be easy to look at someone who survived through all this and stayed physically healthy. It would be almost depressing to you in that situation.
It's the other way around. Mm-hmm. It's inspiring for me. I'm fascinated by people who end up in extremity like this, because I want to see how the people who cope best do it. I want to learn from them, you know. And it's also something that's very familiar for me. I mean, suffering is something that is really been a part of every day of my life since I contracted this disease 24 years ago. And so it's something I'm intimately familiar with. It helps me to talk to people who are former prisoners of war, airmen, because we understand each other. Mm. And it helps me to explore, you know, what are the attributes that enable a man to survive the unsurvivable? Well, Louis knows the answer to that question. And so I wanted to be around him as much as I could.
Are we learning anything more about CFS and what might be done for it?
There's been a lot going on in the last year. There's been a retrovirus that has been identified in a lot of CFS patients that may be the culprit or may not. We're kind of waiting for follow-up studies to give us the answer on that. But there's a lot more research, and it's being taken more seriously, which is really the most important thing to me, because when I first got it, it was just a joke. You know, people trivialized it and dismissed it and had no idea. You know, my life had been shattered by this thing, as is the life of everybody else who has it. But it's we're getting somewhere with it, and I think hopefully within the next few years we'll have workable treatments for us.
Does Louis have a favorite chapter in the book?
Gosh, I don't know. It's funny, when he finished it, he called me and said it was so real to him, he had to keep looking up from the book and remind himself he wasn't there anymore.
Wow.
And I think it was kind of a hard thing for him to read. He said he missed his friends again, and, you know, going through those experiences again in the literature was hard, but I think in the end he was really happy with it. I don't know if there was a favorite part for him.
Laura Hillenbrand's new book is called Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption. Laura, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.